What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Hedging Screens podcast. As always, I'm your host, Zach Cronin. I hope that everybody is doing well mentally, physically, and emotionally. And I thank you for coming to spend some time here with me today. Holy moly, I am super excited for this episode because we got a lot of fun things to talk about. We're going to be talking about Dylan Brooks. Yes, it is Dylan Brooks pack watch time. Everybody, the news finally dropped that Memphis, quote, under no circumstances will not be bringing back the poker of bears. Mr. LeBron James is old, and I am not afraid of him, Dylan Brooks. Mr. I shot 31% from the field in the playoffs. Dylan Brooks will not be back in Memphis. We're also, of course, continuing with our discussions surrounding the NBA playoffs. We have four electrifying series going on right now. We have Denver Phoenix, which is already two games in with Denver taking a 2-0 lead. We have Miami and New York, whose second game will be underway Tuesday this evening. A very reminiscent series from like 30 years ago, which of course is going to be gritty, grimy. I mean, it's already shown to be gritty and grimy. Another fantastic series. We also have Boston and Philadelphia. That series got started on Monday with Philly, without Joel Embiid, stealing home court advantage from the Boston Celtics, courtesy of James Harden getting into the time machine and transporting himself back to 2017, a mystifying performance. We'll get into that as well. And arguably, the best series, personally, my favorite series, begins this evening at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. The Los Angeles Lakers going up against the Golden State Warriors. We once again have a California showdown, but more than that, we have yet another meeting between the two best players of this generation, LeBron James and Steph Curry. My level of excitement for this series is like when I was back in elementary or middle school and you got to class whatever day and all you saw when you sat down was the teacher roll in the TV on that big ass shelf to put on whatever fucking C-rate movie from the 80s. That is how excited I am for this series. I'm struggling to even find a take on this meeting because it's just going to be so fucking good, man. I mean, and of course, the way that both of these teams got here, the Lakers beat the fucking dog shit out of Memphis on Friday, I believe it was, just a 40-point smackdown. Memphis simply could not compete. You know, I knew going into the series that it was going to be difficult for Memphis, but I didn't think that it would be so difficult that they would, like, almost fucking get, like, laughed out of the Staples Center or the fucking whatever arena, whatever crypto arena it's called. Like, it was just unimaginably bad that evening for Memphis. And then, of course, you have Steph Curry taking over in Game 7 this past Sunday, dropping 50 on the Sacramento Kings, 20 of 38 shooting, a career high for him in the postseason, I believe, and also an NBA record for most points in a game seven. And that is just what superstars do. When you are among the all-time greats in a sport, you have all-time great performances. This is yet another signature moment for Steph Curry. I don't know what's going to happen throughout the rest of these playoffs, but should Golden State continue to advance further and further into these playoffs, it's hard to imagine that we're not talking about that 50 burger in game seven against Sacramento in the first round. Honest, as the sixth seed, as one of Steph Curry's, as probably his signature moment, I would say, if Golden State does go on to make the finals or, you know, win the finals, I think that will be, we will talk about that moment, like how we talk about LeBron when he had 45 and 15 against Boston back in the 2012 Eastern Conference semifinals. But in regards to that series, Warriors and Lakers, I don't know who to pick because it can go either way. The Lakers on paper are a little bit stronger to me just in regards to their talent level. I mean, listen, man, it's hard to go against LeBron and AD when LeBron and AD are, you know, at the level that they're at right now. And they're really, like, statistically not as good as we're used to seeing them in the postseason. In that first round series, LeBron averaged 22-11-5, shot 48% from the field, about 49. And then Anthony Davis was not really the dominant player that we were used to seeing, you know, like during the Lakers championship run, for example, averaged just shy of 21 points, did fucking lock down the paint. However, 14 boards, 4.5 blocks. He did have, I think, like 35 in the series finale. Oh, no, he had 31-19 in game 5, which the Lakers lost, and then only had 16-14. I say only 16-14 because, well, he didn't even play 30 minutes that evening, but did throw in 5 blocks as well. At least defensively, this is one of the better versions of Anthony Davis that we've ever seen, and I'm very curious to see how Golden State deals with him both offensively and defensively. Defensively, I'm more so concerned about Golden State because they're, you know, on that side of the ball this year, they have been a tremendous letdown. They've not been the team that we've grown accustomed to seeing throughout their dynasty, but they did hold their own against Sacramento. They were a little bit above average in regards to defensive efficiency, and then I think they were close to average in regards to scoring volume allowed. So I think that with the slimmed down rotation, you know, Steve Kerr again has Andrew Wiggins back, which is huge for them defensively. They have a legitimate lockdown perimeter defender. Of course, you have Draymond Green, and then of course you have Kevon Looney, who looked like fucking Moses Malone against Sacramento. Maybe not from, you know, a defensive rim protecting type of, maybe not as like a rim protector, at least with how like Anthony Davis is, but when you have someone who can secure rebounds like Kevon Looney, your defense is going to be all right, because what's the hardest part of playing defense? Getting the rebound. And you have got a beast in the paint who can secure boards like he's a fucking vacuum cleaner. So I'm going to be very interested to see how Golden State deals with the Lakers offense, because this Lakers team has had one of the most remarkable transformations in the NBA this season, going from a squad who was barely above 500 to not only making the playoffs but beating the two-seeded Memphis Grizzlies. And it's really because of the all-around performances that they've gotten from Austin Reeves and Rui Hachimura. I talked about them as well. This was last week, I believe. I made a video about Memphis and the Lakers that fixated on Dylan Brooks, because Dylan Brooks was ass in that series. But you cannot talk about the Lakers beating Memphis and not actually discuss the reasons why they beat Memphis. LeBron, AD, Austin Reeves, Rui Hachimura, Jared Vanderbilt has emerged as a fantastic perimeter defender as well. So, like, oh, D'Angelo Russell too, who had 31 in the closeout game. The Los Angeles Lakers now have how many? LeBron, AD, D'Lo, Reeves. They have a legitimate six-man rotation. And then you can get quality minutes from Dennis Schroeder at times. You could also maybe get quality minutes from Malik Beasley, at least as a floor spacer, but he didn't really showcase that against Memphis. So yeah, I'm going to be very interested to see if Golden State can actually defend the Lakers. Like, I'm not saying that they can't, because they still have the requisite talent to do so. I don't know if you're able to overcome all of those months of shitty defensive performances against an offense that is as dynamic as this one. But on the flip side, will the Lakers also be able to contend with the Warriors offense? Like, obviously, it's going to be difficult for both of these defenses to get in a rhythm. I would expect a lot of high scoring performances in this series, just because there is so much talent on both ends of the floor. But, you know, what does Anthony Davis look like in this series? How does he prioritize? What does he prioritize? Does he prioritize Do his prioritizations change on a game-by-game basis? Do they change on a quarter-by-quarter basis? Like, after the first quarter, does Darvin Ham sit down with AD and be like, okay, you actually have to, you know, put some pressure on Golden State's defense. Like, we're going to play through you in the post to begin this quarter and then, like, coming out of halftime. Does he maybe take a little bit of a backseat, let Austin Reeves facilitate alongside LeBron and D'Lo for a little bit? Does he just focus more on being that ridiculous shot blocker that he was against Memphis? And I think the Looney Davis matchup is going to be particularly interesting because Domantas Sabonis, by all accounts, did not really have that great of a series against Golden State. Averaged 16 on just about 50% shooting compared to 19 on 61% shooting, largely due to the increased pressure that he faced from Kevon Looney. Kevon Looney in that first round series was tremendous. But, and this is a big but, this is a Kyle Lowry sized but, Anthony Davis is orders of magnitude better offensively than Domantas Sabonis is. I never realized this. Sabonis has no right hand. And I think this is particularly interesting because Sabonis is left-handed. And I myself am left-handed. Now, lefties tend to be more ambidextrous than righties because the world is right-handed. So you're just used to like opening doorknobs with your right hand. You're used to using scissors with your right hand. That does not translate to athletics for some reason. Like, I feel, and this is, of course, anecdotally, I feel that lefties are more likely to go left than righties are to go right. It's just, it's super bizarre. And Golden State literally just took away Sabonis' left hand and, you know, made him look like not the all-NBA player that he is. But Anthony Davis is a legitimately versatile and well-polished offensive talent. He can play in the post. He can face up. He can play in the high post as well as the low post. He can even play on the perimeter a little bit. His mid-range game is filthy. His ability to create space and use his physical gifts is, you know, unrivaled. And, you know, he is, when fully healthy, one of the best players in the NBA. How does Golden State attack him? And is Golden State willing to let Kevon Looney play one-on-one? Because are they going to want to help off of LeBron? Are they going to want to help off of Rui Hachimura? Are they going to want to help off of Austin Reeves or D'Angelo Russell or whomever it is? So there's going to be a lot of defensive pressure put on Kevon Looney on Golden State's side. And then the guards for the Lakers, because who do you put on Steph Curry? Like, I'm looking at this roster. I think you maybe stick Jared Vanderbilt on him because he is your best perimeter defender. No fucking way that D'Angelo Russell guards Steph Curry with any efficacy at all. There's no way that Austin Reeves guards him with any efficacy at all. You can't take LeBron off of somebody like Draymond and put him on Steph Curry for extended minutes. So it's gonna be very interesting to see how both of these coaches develop their defensive schemes. I will say there will be a ton of goofiness thrown at both of these offenses. Steve Kerr is known to switch up his defensive schemes from time to time. And actually, a large reason why Golden State's defense was not that great this year is because they lost that element of surprise, just because they didn't have the personnel to throw all of these looks at the different teams that they were playing. But of course, it's different now that Andrew Wiggins is here. It's different now that you have GP2 back. Like, you have a lot of the same pieces that were with you throughout the dynasty. So yeah, like, I'm expecting a very wacky defensive performance from the Warriors as well as the Lakers. I still do think that offense will reign supreme here. And it's for that reason why I don't know who to pick, because, like, statistically, Golden State was second in scoring offense this year, eighth in offensive efficiency. The Lakers were sixth in scoring volume, albeit 20th in efficiency. However, there's only about 2 points per 100 possessions, not even 1.5 points per 100 possessions separating these two teams. And the Lakers metric in that regard includes their explosive second half of the season. So I really don't know who to pick in this situation. It's ultimately going to come down to LeBron and Steph Curry. Whoever is better between these two, their team is going to advance. I think, with that being said, I think the Lakers have a slight edge in that regard. I think we are going to see a nuclear level event from LeBron James in this series. He historically has put on some of his best performances against Golden State. I think he averages like 33 points and 9 assists against Golden State in the postseason while shooting close to 50% from the field. I don't give a damn that he's old. I don't give a damn that he has all this mileage on his body. I think he's going to turn back the clock. It's going to look like 2016, 2017 era LeBron James and just be the best player in every category on both sides of the ball. I think that Steph Curry is also going to have a tremendous series. He's arguably been the best player in this postseason so far. I think the only guy that's been better than Steph has been Jimmy Butler. I mean, Steph is averaging like fucking 33 points on 50% shooting. It's remarkable. And especially the 50 burger that he put up in Sacramento, he had a very, very poor performance from the three-point line. Okay, maybe not like super poor, but he was 7 of 18, which is about 38%. Okay, so not the worst performance, but this is a guy who we're used to seeing shoot 40, 42. Like, that is the type of level that we're expecting from Steph Curry. If he's taking 18 threes, we're expecting to see him go like 10 of 18. But taking what the defense gives you, utilizing floaters, mid-range, being crafty with your dribble also helps that Sacramento does not have a lockdown defender that they could have put on Steph Curry. I mean, you know, Jared Vanderbilt is that. You can also bother him with a little bit of size with Rui Hachimura, maybe. And there is also, of course, you can switch LeBron onto him every now and then. You can switch Anthony Davis onto him every now and then, but I don't know if that's an entirely sustainable strategy. But I'm rolling with the Lakers in this series by the slimmest of margins. I will say, again, I am uber excited to watch this series. You have two of the greatest players of all time, the two best players of this current generation of basketball, going up against one another. And every time that they've met in the playoffs before, it's been entertainment. Even, you know, even the years where Golden State was clearly better than those Cleveland Cavaliers teams, you couldn't look away, because what's LeBron going to do this game? What's Steph going to do this game? And like, the results have been even better when their teams are evenly matched. And these are two evenly matched basketball teams going up against one another in the playoffs. I mean, they're one seed. They're the sixth and the seventh seed. So, yeah, I'm super excited for that. I think the other series that I'm most excited for is Boston-Philly. Even though I despise both of these teams, these are without a doubt my two least favorite teams in the NBA. Just, you know, as a Nets fan, as, you know, divisional rivals, I just do not like them. I also do not like the 76ers because they eliminated the Brooklyn Nets this year. But this series, I don't know if I would have said this prior to the series starting, but after watching what James Harden did, a 45-point performance on 17 of 30 shooting on the road without Joel Embiid, man, Philly is better than I thought. I thought that Boston, they're the team to beat for me. I still think that without Milwaukee, they are going to be NBA championships. They're going to be the NBA champions. They're just the best, most complete, most well-rounded team on both sides of the court. But they got bested in this one. And it was spectacular. You had a late game blunder by, I think it was Malcolm Brogdon, threw the ball away late in the game, giving two easy points to Tyrese Maxey, who again had a decent game, 26, despite shooting just 10 of 24, including 2 of 9 from 3. But again, this does not make any sense because Joel Embiid was not there. Joel Embiid is Philly's best offensive player. He's their best defensive player, and that showed, by the way. They were getting fucking clobbered in the paint to start the game because there was no Joel Embiid. There was no rim protection. And yet, Philly is fantastic when he's not there. They improved to 13-5 this year, I believe, when Joel Embiid is not in the lineup. I mean, that does include their games against Brooklyn. But still, when you're without the MVP, when you're without an MVP candidate, an MVP finalist, this scoring champion, there is going to be a sizable drop-off in your performance, or at least you would expect that. Also, more so when you consider the fact that Harden is older. He's 33, okay? This isn't 2016, 2017, 2018 James Harden. This is James Harden that has gotten older, that has been through a couple injuries, who should not be able to put on performances like this. I will say that 26 from Tyrese Maxey is more sustainable than 45 from James Harden. You also got 18 from Tobias Harris. You had 17 crucial points from DeAnthony Melton. And of course, Paul Reed with 10 points and 13 boards to really just be a solid five in the absence of Joel Embiid. And he was that. Now, overall, Philly shot 51% from the field, 45% from three. There was not a lick of defense played in this game, guys. 59% shooting from Boston, including 39% from three. And you're like, how the fuck did they lose this game? How do you get 39-11 from Jason Tatum? How do you get 23 from Jaylen Brown, 20 from Malcolm Brogdon, 12 from Marcus Smart? How is your team have five double-digit scorers and you lose this game? And it was literally that one mistake that they made towards the end, when Malcolm Brogdon threw the ball away and gave Tyrese Maxey an easy layup with, I think, less than a minute left. That was it. However, I still don't think Philly beats Boston in a series without Joel Embiid, because I did not believe that Philly would beat Boston in a series with Joel Embiid. This was an anomalous performance from James Harden. As spectacular as it was to watch, as entertaining as it was to watch James Harden look like he was 6-7 years younger, he's not going to be able to do this every night. I think the Celtics defense was thrown for a little bit of a loop, because you didn't know if Joel Embiid was going to be playing up until about 3 hours before tip-off. So the game plan revolves around Embiid. The way that the coach constructs his game plan is centered around Joel Embiid, at least on defense, and I'm talking about Joe Mazzulla in this instance. When he is not there, you are kind of in no man's land. You're kind of on the fly attempting to adjust how to guard this team, because everything you talked about, all of your principles go out the window. And then, of course, you can't predict for 45 points from James Harden, but I do think that everybody's going to settle in. Harden's production is going to normalize. He's going to go down to about 20, I'd say maybe 25 or so. I'd say maybe 25 a night. And, you know, Boston is still talented enough on defense to smother the Sixers offense, especially if they're not making threes. That was a huge savior for them, was DeAnthony Melton and James Harden combining to go 12 of 20 from the three-point line. That is huge shot making. That is clutch shot making against an elite defense. I don't foresee that happening throughout the rest of the series, especially if Boston's offense is going to play like this. And this is how Boston's offense plays. You get big performances from Tatum and Brown. Okay, you're going to get 55, 60 points from them every night. Okay, maybe, you know, 20 from Brogdon is kind of a lot, but you're going to get production from Marcus Smart. You're going to get great defense from Al Horford. And he was tremendous defensively on Monday night. Now, the focus shifts a little bit, because when does Joel Embiid come back? I would not be surprised if he comes back for game two, for game three, because Philly needs him. If he's healthy enough to play, I feel that he's going to want to be out there. I think that, you know, the Sixers medical staff looked at it. They looked at the situation. They consulted with the coaches, and they came to the consensus that it's game one on the road. It's likely a game that we're not going to win anyway. Let's have him take another day off to see if he can get a little bit closer to 100%. I mean, even they could look at going down 2-0 and going back to Philly as, you know, they could see it as not like a good thing, but a situation that they wouldn't mind being in, because it's not necessarily uncommon. Like, you know, a series doesn't start until a team wins on the road. So even going back to Philly down 2-0, if you do and you wind up getting a healthy Joel Embiid, it's basically a best of five at that point. Or, yeah, something like that. Yeah, whatever. You guys know what the fuck I'm trying to say. But even if Embiid is like 70 to 80% healthy, it's better long-term for the Sixers, or at least in regards to this series, than if he is absent. Because Embiid, even if he's on a minutes restriction of like 25, 27 minutes, he's going to give you 20 and 7. He's going to be an extra 20 points on the board. And then just think about like even the added dynamic of him being healthy again, how Boston is going to have to readjust, how they're not going to be able to like float Al Horford around, or like, because when Embiid is healthy, yeah, I think Boston will still switch a healthy amount. But when Embiid is back on the court, Al Horford is going to be glued to him, because Al Horford is your best defensive big man. Joel Embiid is the best offensive center in the game. You're going to want to have, that's the only matchup that will not result in Boston getting abused on the block. And I think it's one that they can lean on, because Al Horford is a fucking damn good defender. So I still like Boston in this series. But man, you've seen a bunch of upsets already. This would be another seismic upset. I mean, it was a seismic upset even after one game. If Philly would be able to bounce the reigning Eastern Conference champions without the MVP finalist, I would not hesitate to say that this was the goofiest year in NBA playoff history. So now we're going to shift to Nuggets Suns. And I want to shift to the series, because this is a series, guys. Although Denver is up 2-0, there is a lot to discuss, and there are many ways that this series can go. There is still a situation there. Like, I do not rule out the Phoenix Suns quite yet. Okay, you have Kevin Durant and Devin Booker averaging 57 combined. Both are shooting about 50% from the field. As it stands right now, D-Book is at 31. KD is at 26.5. Both of these fools are playing this well, while also averaging upwards of 40 minutes a night. Great scoring, remarkable efficiency. I mean, KD has looked tremendous on defense, as we've seen him turn it up from time to time. Devin Booker is once again returning to form, looking like the best pure scorer in the NBA. He's taken on a little bit more of a playmaker's role as well. But on the other side, you have Nikola Jokic, who is just, he is on a different level right now. 31.5 points, 17.5 boards, and 5 assists. I will say this, however, I was not expecting this type of metric, but Jokic shot about 61% from the field this year. In this series, he's down to 51. Now, that's still great efficiency, but 51 from a dude who's close to 7 foot is not what you would expect. And it is because DeAndre Ayton, folks, you are hearing this correctly. DeAndre Ayton is playing commendable defense against the two-time league MVP. According to the NBA's tracking data, when guarded by DeAndre Ayton, Jokic is shooting just 16 of 32. 50% from DeAndre Ayton, who is, of course, a decent defender, not someone who's known from his defense for his defensive prowess. He's like definitely not going to ever be a defensive player of the year candidate. But yeah, 16 of 32. I mean, Jokic has only scored 37. I say only. I mean, scored 37 points in 17 minutes when guarded by Ayton through these two games. That is not something that I would have expected to be talking about on this show, was how DeAndre Ayton's defensive performance is, you know, worth is like it's commendable. It's respectable. It's really quite shocking, actually. But they are going to need more from Ayton going forward offensively. 14 a night on 67% shooting, 14 of 21 overall from the field. They have to be able to run their offense through DeAndre Ayton at some point. And I don't know if this is going to be possible, because the one issue that Phoenix had going into this postseason was their lack of depth. Ever since trading for Kevin Durant, you get rid of Cam Johnson, you get rid of Mikal Bridges. You had Jay Crowder last year. He's gone. He's actually probably going to Cancun. He's probably on his way to Cancun right now, but he's no longer with the team. So you're trying to like find guys who can occupy some minutes. Like Damian Lee's been getting time. Josh Okogie's been getting time. Torrey Craig's been getting time. I don't know what's going on with TJ Warren, but I would assume that if he's healthy, he would be seeing some time. But Phoenix's bench has not performed well. I think they've scored like 28 combined points through these two games so far. And they're not going to win this series if they're not getting any production, any sizable production outside of Devin Booker and Kevin Durant. Now, I will say, at least in regards to game two, things were looking decent for Phoenix. Phoenix was actually up 42-40 going into halftime. They were leading in the third quarter as well. But Chris Paul wound up leaving the game. I know Chris Paul is old. I know he may no longer be the point god to some people, but he provides a very valuable skill to this team, and that is the ability to conduct the offense. That is the ability to dictate who goes where, the ability to dictate where KD and Devin Booker go. And also, he still has the passing chops to find these guys when they're open. And without a legitimate facilitator, the Suns' offense just came to a halt. They were noticeably worse down the stretch of this game because they couldn't rely on anyone to reinvigorate. They couldn't rely on anybody on the court to revitalize this offense. I mean, they scored 14 in the fourth, 14 points on 7 of 25 shooting against a Denver Nuggets defense that is not that great statistically. So losing Chris Paul is a huge blow. We don't know when he's going to be coming back. They were talking about it on the broadcast yesterday. It was something with his left groin. I don't know if it's just, you know, he stretched a little bit too hard on a play or whatever. But if Chris Paul cannot go, combined with the struggles that Phoenix's bench has had. I mean, I'm going down. Like, look at this box score, guys. I know that you guys listening can't see it, but you sort by points. It's 62 from Devin Booker. Okay, very respectable. 53 from KD. Okay, you know, that's Kevin Durant. 28 from Ayton. 19 from Chris Paul. And then it goes to 7 from Jock Landale. 7 for Cameron Payne. 4 for Josh Okogie. 3 for Torrey Craig. 3 for Damian Lee. 3 for Landry Shamet, 3 for Ish Wainwright, and then 2 for Bismack Biyombo. This is a frightening predicament for the Phoenix Suns. And, you know, I was just talking about a few minutes ago how when we were discussing Lakers-Grizzlies, we can't talk about the Grizzlies' struggles without also talking about the Lakers' successes. And the Denver Nuggets are very similar in this regard. Phoenix is not doing themselves any favors with their lack of depth. I mean, obviously, you can't predict injuries as well, so I'm not going to hold that against them. But Denver has gotten production from the most unexpected sources. I'm talking big-time production from the most unexpected sources. Of course, Nikola Jokic is going to perform. Jamal Murray had a super shitty game too, but did come alive down the stretch. He's still at 44 points through these two games, had a monstrous game one, dropped in 34. Jamal Murray is very much Canadian Jimmy Butler at this point when it comes to the playoffs. But their third highest scorer, guys, is Aaron Gordon at 19.5 points. You know what Aaron Gordon averaged during the regular season? Oh, fuck. It was 16? All right. Well, fuck me then. Regardless, they're getting close to 20 points a night from Aaron Gordon. And just think about how much more violent these beatdowns would be if they were getting that production from Aaron Gordon. And also, if they were getting what they expected from Michael Porter Jr. Michael Porter Jr. has scored 16 points in just two games. He shot 7 of 16 from the field. He has not had a good series thus far. He has also not really been playing that many minutes. He's at 27 right now, played 23 in game 5 after playing 39 and 31 in games 1 and 2, respectively. I think largely because you had KCP, who was getting hot down the stretch of that game. And also because when it is defensive-focused, Aaron Gordon, if he continues to play like this, any defensive battle down the stretch will result in Michael Malone picking Aaron Gordon over Michael Porter Jr. Why is this, you may ask? And doubly so because whichever one of those two is on the court is going to be guarding Kevin fucking Durant. Aaron Gordon, thus far, has held KD to 8 of 20 shooting. And he's also forced him into 5 turnovers. This is like Kawhi Leonard level defense on LeBron James. I don't know if this is like going to be talked about in the national media. I hope it is, but Aaron Gordon's defensive performance is incredible. It's marvelous. It's remarkable. It's magnificent. It's every superlative that you could imagine from a guy who is not known from being that great of a defender. Like, Aaron Gordon is not someone whom I think of among defensive stoppers. He is average at best, and a lot of his averageness comes from the tremendous physical gifts that he has. He's got great size. He's 6'8". He's got decent length, and he's hyper athletic. I mean, super bothersome on Kevin Durant. I was watching the fourth quarter of this game, and you can tell. Like, I've seen a bunch of people bother KD. I saw Jason Tatum bother Kevin Durant last year. I'm getting similar shades of that from Aaron Gordon. And it's just a relentless falling of one of the greatest scorers of all time. So shout out to Aaron Gordon. And again, doing this in what should have been Michael Porter Jr.'s minutes. And then, of course, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope shooting 7 of 12 from 3 so far. Bruce Brown, I already talked about Michael Porter Jr., Jeff Green. I will say, as much shit as I was giving the Suns bench for not performing, Denver's bench has statistically been only a little bit better than Phoenix. I think Phoenix's bench scored 28 through two games. I think Denver's bench is at like maybe 32. So there isn't a tremendous amount of difference. But just again, when you look at like a couple of the guys who are coming off the bench for them, Bruce Brown, Jeff Green, and Christian Brown are three dudes who have routinely given Denver high quality minutes this year. I mean, Bruce Brown and Jeff Green before Denver giving high quality minutes to the Brooklyn Nets as well. I don't see that coming off of the bench for Phoenix. Like, there are none of these guys that really jump out to me. I mean, Torrey Craig is a good defender. Damian Lee has the potential to be a floor spacer, but Cameron Payne, Jock Landale, none of these guys really, they don't do it for me. Like, they just don't pass the vibes test, unfortunately. And like that, like, Phoenix could, like, they could deal with it, but if Chris Paul is not healthy, I think that is a bigger blow than some people may want to give them credit for. Because, again, the inability to settle the offense, to dictate the offense, to just be a leader is a tremendous thing that teams need in moments like this. I mean, even the Clippers. The Clippers were a significantly different team before and after Russell Westbrook. And Russell Westbrook isn't even that good of a facilitator. Like, when people think of Russell Westbrook, they just think of a electrifying athlete who makes things happen by going downhill, when he is in fact like a legitimate floor general, especially now that he was in a situation where he didn't have to, you know, be a score first guy. Like, the Suns need that. And unfortunately, they, like, Cameron Payne is certainly Not that. Devin Booker, as good of a playmaker as he's turned into, he is not that. And Kevin Durant is not that as well. And the final series is, yeah, the final series already, holy moly, is Heat-Knicks. Man, if you were to tell me that both the Heat and the Knicks would be playing each other in the conference finals, I would have laughed at you straight up. You mean to tell me that, okay, maybe not because of the Knicks, because the Knicks, I didn't think they were going to beat Cleveland, but they were very clearly better than Cleveland. But the Heat beating the Bucks, again, already I made a video on that as well. Just not something I expected. And this really is a series that is 30 years, that is 30 years back in time. These two teams, historically, two of the better teams in the Eastern Conference, right, throughout the 90s, the early 2000s, whatever. And here they are, rehashing and bringing back all of the basketball that the fucking old heads love so much. Dirty, grimy, dingy, non-electrifying NBA basketball. Of course, I'm being a little hyperbolic here. RJ Barrett and Jalen Brunson are fantastic talents. Playoff Jimmy Butler is a beast as well. I mean, he had 25 and 11 in game one despite injuring his ankle. And again, played fucking 43 minutes. This psychopath did. It is so difficult for me to gauge this series just because the Heat are so unexpected. And also, additionally, both of these teams have noticeable deficiencies in certain aspects. For the Knicks, it's their defense. Defense is dog shit, or was dog shit this year. 19th overall in defensive rating. We're better against Cleveland. I did commend their defensive effort, especially from Mitchell Robinson, Jalen Brunson. So they did look better against Cleveland, but also I don't think Cleveland did themselves any favors offensively. And for Miami, it's three-point shooting. They shot the fucking lights out. They shut the fucking lights out against Milwaukee. It was like they were in Splinter Cell on a stealth mission with the way they blasted all those fucking lamps. Now, to me, the winner of this series is going to be the one who can better compensate for their deficiencies or mask their deficiencies. And because of that, I don't think Miami, despite having a one-game lead, I don't think they beat the Knicks. I fucking cannot believe that I'm picking the New York Knicks to go to an Eastern Conference Finals in 2023. But that is what my heart is telling me. Jalen Brunson and RJ Barrett, should they continue to play like this, they will be tough for Miami to contend with. And this is also with New York not shooting particularly well from the perimeter. 7 of 34. These guys were on Sunday, including 0 of 7 from Jalen Brunson. That is not going to continue to happen. Jalen Brunson is too good of a player to shoot 0% from three. Like, this is a guy who shot 41% from three during the regular season. Like, it's not going to happen again. It's simply not going to. Miami, on the other hand, is also their three-point shooting is beginning to normalize as well. They were down to 33% in that game. I'm just going through the box score. Like, Gabe Vincent, 5 of 12. Kyle Lowry, 3 of 6. Like, that was really it. I mean, Kevin Love and Max Strus were both 2 for 5, but not really that high volume. I don't foresee Miami having another upset in them. Because, I mean, the Knicks showed it last series. They can defend. Like, Josh Hart can defend. Jalen Brunson can defend. Mitchell Robinson can defend. It's just going to be a matter of, very much like with the Bucks, I guess, are they going to allow Jimmy Butler to just fucking eat? And if they do allow Jimmy Butler to eat, are they not going to make any adjustments on him? It's only one game, so it's hard to tell. But I do think that New York figures out a way to pull this out. I'm just going to the box score. The Knicks lost this game in the third quarter, 31-20. They were outscored. By far their worst quarter of the day. They basically erased the lead that they built in the first. And that is more or less what I was expecting to see during this game. Just like the Knicks running like a well-oiled offense. Jalen Brunson getting downhill, getting into the paint, playing bully ball despite the fact that he's not big enough to play bully ball. And if the Knicks shoot better from three, this is an entirely different discussion we're having. If the Knicks did not shoot 21% from three, they're probably beating Miami by like 12 or 15, which does not bode well for their prospects, because New York, they were a good three-point shooting team this year. At least I think. 35%. All right. 35%, 19th best overall. Not that great, but fucking better than Miami. So, yeah, goddamn. I'm really picking the fucking New York Knicks to beat the Heat. That is crazy to me. So that does it for the playoff series. Goddamn, man. I'm so fucking excited for all of this. And now, the big, fat, thick, juicy piece of news that blasted across our TLs this morning, courtesy of none other than Shams Charania. And this news is about the Poker of Bears, Dylan Brooks. Guys, I'm going small screen for this. This featured image is foul, by the way. The featured image that The Athletic did for that article is absolutely foul. So the tweet reads like this. The Memphis Grizzlies have informed pending free agent Dylan Brooks that he will not be brought back under any circumstances, league sources tell The Athletic. There was a later report from, or not a report, but a continuation of this report from Bleacher Report, I want to say it was, where basically there were contract extension talks at the beginning of the season that never amounted to anything. And Dylan Brooks did not do himself any favors this year. And we're going to get to this. But before we do, we got to talk about bad takes. Because there are numerous people in the NBA media sphere, numerous people who have positions on talk shows for large media companies, who are doing their viewers a disservice by crafting narratives that aren't even like entertaining. They're not related to any of the goings on. One of these guys that I'm talking about is Kendrick Perkins. His take wasn't even a fucking take. This guy went on Twitter and said, "Oh, I see what's going on in Memphis. They're making Dylan Brooks the fall guy. BS. That freak culture is who they've been the last 3 years. Wasn't a problem until they got embarrassed. Leadership needs some of that smoke to carry on." This, of course, if you're like, imagine you're a normie and you see Kendrick Perkins talking about this, you would think that Dylan Brooks was putting up Ja Morant numbers this year for Memphis to not extend him seemingly because of the attitude that he had, the quote-unquote villainous attitude that he grew more and more into throughout the year. You would think that, you know, they were upset that he called LeBron old. They were upset that he said, quote-unquote, "I poke bears." And that is simply not the case. This guy stinks. Dylan Brooks stinks. I even said last week in the video that I made, I don't mind this attitude that Dylan Brooks plays with. I think it's fun. I think it's entertaining. I like when athletes have an edge. However, there should be you should not be allowed to call yourself a villain if you're shooting 39.6% from the field. If you're shooting 32.6% from three in the playoffs. Kendrick Perkins, please. I need you to understand. Dylan Brooks did not get extended because of his antics. He didn't get extended because he shot 31.2% from the field in these playoffs. He shot 23.8% from three. This guy is a detriment to your team. He has, over the course of his career, improved. He improved a little bit from his rookie year after getting injured as a sophomore. And then, you know, he had the makings of being a good quality player. Let's not forget, this is the same Dylan Brooks that averaged 26 a night back in 2021 when Memphis went up against the Utah Jazz. He stinks. The idea that he is a fall guy is simply not true. Like, a legitimate fall guy, Russell Westbrook on the Lakers. All right? Poor performance, yes. However, he was not in a Russell Westbrook on the Lakers, and his performance, like, admittedly wasn't even that poor. It was poor compared to, like, previous versions of him. But again, Russ should have not been in LA. It was in a bad he was in a bad position. He was asked to do things he wasn't able to do. Dylan Brooks, all Memphis asks him to do is defend and shoot threes, and he can't do half of that. And now there have been players in the past who have been nothing burgers on offense. And one of them played for Memphis. Do you guys remember? I don't know if all you youngins who are listening remember Tony Allen. But Tony Allen was one of, fuck it, he was the best perimeter defender of his time. Just incredible. And he played for the Memphis Grizzlies. He was a member of the Grit and Grind Grizzlies. Dog shit offensive player. Averaged 8 points for his career. Shot 28% from three. I mean, overall, he shot close to like 48% from the field overall, but not in like not a reliable source of offense in any way. But do you know how you offset that? You offset that by being the guy who Kobe Bryant and Kevin Durant said was the best defender they ever played against. That's how you offset that. Dylan Brooks is an above average defender at best. He's not first team all defense. He's like nowhere even close to Tony Allen. I think that Tony Allen as a freshman in college was probably better at defending NBA players than Dylan Brooks is now. But to insinuate that the Memphis Grizzlies front office is making Dylan Brooks a fall guy is just a completely asinine point that should not be allowed to be repeated. Actually, I don't want to say that. That's kind of mean. Like, yeah, Kendrick Perkins is entitled to his opinion, but that is a dog shit opinion. It's simply untrue. How are you, dude? You can't be the fall guy if you're shooting 31% from the field. It's like Memphis, under no circumstances, is not bringing back Dylan Brooks, because under no circumstances did Dylan Brooks make any shots for them in the playoffs. They're not going to pay this guy $18, $19, $20 million a year, whatever the fuck he felt he deserved. They're not going to pay him $20 million a year to fucking shoot themselves in the feet. They're basically playing 4-on-5 offensively, and his defensive production isn't even enough to offset that. Because, like, yeah, you have defensive specialists throughout the NBA, but all of said defensive specialists are elite defenders. Dylan Brooks is not that. And he's not giving you enough on offense to even, like, consider. Like, I don't give a fuck that he's the fourth option on that team. If your job is to make threes and you're not making threes, your team is not gonna bring you back. And, like, I'm here for all of the get ready to learn Chinese buddy jokes because, you know, it's funny. But, like, there's just a realer conversation to be had. And again, I keep falling back to this point. Like, there's no issue with Dylan Brooks talking trash. I like trash talk. I think it's healthy. But, like, if the NBA should find players who talk trash while shooting less than 40% from the field, the only way you avoid that is if you're like an Allen Iverson type guy. Like, you're hovering around 40%, but you're averaging like 28. Like, Dylan Brooks should not be allowed to talk trash. It should be like a $500 fine. No, it should be like a swear jar where every time he talks trash to somebody, he has to put a dollar into the Brooks jar. It's like the Mendoza line in baseball. If you're batting under 200, it's the Mendoza line. If you're shooting under 40%, that's the Brooks line. And if you're talking trash while shooting below that figure, You got to pay up because we have to, like, you can't be bad and talk trash. You can't, dude, this, like, it's so poetic. Like, hold on. We got to go back to this fool's page for a second. He called LeBron old and then proceeded to have 12 points, 7 points, 11 points, 8 points, and 10 points. Dog, you shot better than 36% one fucking time. How is LeBron, like, 13 years older than you, and you can't even, like, sniff 40%? Like, what is the opposite of an attribute boost? Because that's what Dylan Brooks deployed before this series. Just in no way, shape, or form was he equipped to deal with anything. And I think Dylan Brooks 1,000,000% signs a contract somewhere else, because I feel the main reason these talks broke down was because Brooks was asking for way more money than Memphis thought was justified. And I tend to agree, because if Dylan Brooks came to me and was demanding all this bread, it's like, dog, you're shooting 35% from the... What makes you think you're deserving of that? Like, I think $13 million a year, like his rookie scale deal, would still be a little too much. Pay $13 million a year for a guy to shoot 1 of 8 from 3 every night? I'm going to pass on that. Yeah, I think that'll just about do it. We covered everything. Talked about Dylan Brooks pack watch. Talked about all the playoff series. So, yeah, as always, thank you guys so much for coming to hang out with me today. As always, everything I'm associated with is linked down in the description box below. Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, the YouTube channel. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. If you catch any of these videos on the channel, leave a like as well. All of these episodes are available wherever podcasts are. Listen to Apple, Spotify, follow the show, leave a rating, subscribe, leave a review, engage with it. Or if you can, of course, if you enjoyed this episode, tell a friend about it. Why not tell a friend about it? Once again, thank you guys so much. I'll catch y'all in the next one.